Good evening.
Welcome to the second of what I'd like to call a spring series of the Vancouver Institute. Some people may think of it as the winter series, particularly looking out this evening. My name's John Madden. I'm the president this year of the Vancouver Institute. Just before I introduce our speaker for this evening, I'd like to do a little poll that I do every once in a while, if I could, and could have your cooperation. First of all, I wonder if those of you for whom this is the first lecture this season, by which I mean since we started in the fall, could raise your hands just so that I get some feel. Quite a number of you, thank you. Could I ask how many of you heard about this lecture through the advertisements in the newspaper? Okay, thank you very much. And could I ask if those of you who are members might raise your hands? Oh, look at all the members! Isn't that wonderful? Thank you. Now there may have been some of you, and some of you have heard this before, who didn't raise your hands on any of these questions. In which case, I'm hoping that you'll feel just a slight tinge of guilt and motivation on your way out to think about either joining the Institute or possibly making a donation. For your information, the speakers are not paid, so our expenses are not high, and most of our expenses, in fact, are for running those ads, which have brought so many of you here. So that to the extent that you do contribute, you can think of helping others to come and enjoy this evening. I should just mention, too, that our next speaker on February the 10th, next Saturday night, is Madame Lysiane Gagnon, the political columnist with La Presse, and she also has a weekly column with the Globe and Mail, and her topic will be Between Two Referendums, the Future of Quebec and Canada. Now, some of us had a debate about referenda and referendums, but the topic is, in fact, Between Two Referendums. Bob Evans was born in London and came to Canada at a young age. I gather it was actually 3 and a half. After graduating from the University of Toronto with a gold medal, he went on to Harvard, where he obtained a PhD in economics in 1970. His doctoral dissertation was entitled Efficiency Incentives in Hospital Reimbursement. He's kept fairly close to those kinds of subjects since. Fortunately for us, Bob came to UBC as an assistant professor in 1969 and has remained at UBC's economics department since, becoming a full professor in 1978. Though he has spent time away as visiting professor at the Universities of Toronto and Auckland, and has been a commissioner, member, consultant, or whatever, on many panels and commissions related to healthcare, including the BC Royal Commission on Healthcare and Costs in 1990-91, the International Review Panel of the Swedish Healthcare System, the World Bank Senior Health Policy Seminar in Beijing in 1993, the National Academy of Social Insurance in the U.S., and the LSE health team reviewing the Greek health services. When the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, whose president Fraser Mustard addressed us last Saturday evening, initiated its highly successful population health program in 1987, Bob was the natural and happy choice as the program director. Bob, I understand, will be touching on some aspects of that program, but we'll also be talking about some other subjects this evening. Let me just say that it's my belief that the beneficial effects of this program alone on our province, our country, and indeed on many other countries as well, has already paid for all the CIAR programs many times over. Bob is on the board of editors of a number of journals, including the Journal of Health Politics. Bob, I didn't know there was such a thing as health politics. The Journal of Health Economics and the International Journal of Technology Assessment. I should warn Bob that last week I billed him as the funniest economist I know. This is a cruel thing to do, as there can be no advantage to Bob in raising expectations in this manner. However, he can take comfort in the knowledge that most members of the audience will probably hold the view that economics is a dismal science and would have felt that a funny economist was an oxymoron almost on a par with such phrases as virtual reality. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Robert Evans, who will address us on the subject Healthy, Wealthy, and Cunning, Profit and Loss from Healthcare Reform. Thank you.
I think can I get away with this? What happened to this mic? Curled over and died.
Did you do that?
I did. Oh, yes, I'm not surprised. Can anyone hear with this mic? Is that working all right? Okay. It's always worth checking to make sure that the people who want to hear can hear and the ones who don't can't. That actually is the kiss of death, John, being referred to as the funniest economist. Of course, as you point out, the expectations are really pretty low. Although there is a tradition among health economists, for reasons that I don't wholly understand, that there seem to be quite a number of them in different parts of the world who make a living as amateur stand-up comics, and there's even one in New Zealand, a colleague who has now gone into the business professionally and given up being an economist entirely. Quite sure what this proves. I would first, however, speaking of low expectations, like to express my deep gratitude to all of you who have come tonight. You can imagine my thoughts when I looked out the door about an hour ago and saw that it was snowing, and thought about the prospects for freezing rain later on in the evening, and I thought, would I come out to a lecture on economics on a night like this? And the answer was no. But you have, and I'm very grateful for that, because it wouldn't be at all the same without you. I am quite short-sighted, but I can tell an empty seat when I see one. I'm actually very grateful for the opportunity to talk to this group again. I was invited here some years ago, back in 1988, right at the beginning of the program in population health that John Madden's referred to. And at that time, I had pulled together a few ideas from my colleagues and strung them into some thoughts that seemed to me to be interesting. It was very much an experimental exercise at that time. I suppose it still is. But it has subsequently given rise to a book on the subject that we're rather pleased with. I'm not going to talk much about that tonight. We've done that, been there, don't have a t-shirt on it, but I suppose we could. I'm going to do much the same thing again, of trying to link together some experimental thoughts to see whether they hang together in a way that you will find interesting. Those of you who may have been here last week, wow, that's, whoo. Yes, it's going to be interesting. Those of you who were here last week will have heard Dr. Fraser Mustard, the president of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, which I think could be best described as a subversive intellectual exercise. At least we intend it to be subversive. Will have some notion of the kind of breadth and eclecticism that goes into the CIIR programs, and you're going to see some of that tonight, that I'm going to be drawing ideas from a number of different areas, and in particular, I'm going to be building the front end of my talk around some very intriguing thoughts that come from a chap by the name of Tad Homer Dixon, who is a political scientist runs the Peace and Conflict Studies program at the University of Toronto. Tad is interested in environmental change and violent conflict. And you may, or you may not, wonder what an economist interested in healthcare reform is doing working with an intellectual apparatus developed by a political scientist interested in violent conflict. I think you will find that there is a connection. I hope you will. And it is my thought that the work that he has done does provide an intellectual basis for thinking about some of the things that are going on in the health reform process, not just in Canada, but in many countries in the world, although I'm going to focus my remarks tonight pretty much on Canada. The downside of that is that the kind of eclectic, broad-based, multidisciplinary, just about everything, thinking that goes on in a program like ours in the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research can be mightily entertaining and extraordinarily shallow. That's the great danger with multidisciplinary research. It's a whole lot of fun, but it can very easily turn into a bull session. And so I guess the test really of whether the ideas that you're putting together make sense is whether they seem to be helpful, useful to audiences with a number of different kinds of interests. So in some ways, you're sort of a test case for these ideas tonight as we begin to probe them further and see whether when you try to push them a bit, push a bit deeper with them, you actually do find something useful emerging. Now, the first thing, though, that I guess one should deal with is, why do you need a broader framework of understanding? Why do you need to go and look at international political science theory to think about health reform anyhow, when you're supposed to be coming at this as an economist in Canada? Why the broader frame of understanding? And I guess the quick answer is boredom. That's not a complete answer, but it actually leads into, I think, what the real motivation for this is. John mentioned that I served under Mr. Justice Peter Seaton on the BC Royal Commission on Healthcare and Costs. When that report came out, a columnist in Victoria, on the Times Colonist, wrote quite an insightful little column listing recommended reforms in the healthcare system. And then when he got to the end, he said, "You probably think these are the recommendations of the Seaton Commission that has just come out." This was 1991 or early 92. "They're not," he said. "These are the recommendations of the Folks Report of 1973. But they could have been the recommendations of the Seaton Commission, and in fact, some of them are. But they're also the recommendations of the Folks Report." And that's an extremely important point, that those same sets of ideas keep coming back and back and back over and over again. Okay. On another level, bringing it even closer to home, one of our commissioners, David Sinclair, brought in a clipping that referred to the need to reduce our utilization of hospital beds in Canada, and particularly in British Columbia, and pointing to the fact that hospital beds were being heavily overutilized and something needed to be done about this. And this was a quote from the Dean of Medicine at UBC. But it was not a quote from Dean Hollenberg. It was a quote from Dean Jack McCreary, and the date was 1965. Yet again, the whole debate on privatization or not privatization of our healthcare system, two-tier or preservation of one-tier, open or keep closed the Canada Health Act, all those issues, there's virtually nothing, in fact, I would venture to say nothing new being said there. All of those arguments were brought forward in front of Mr. Justice Hall back in the late 50s and early 60s. They were all rehashed again in the run-up to the Canada Health Act in 1984. How many times do we have to keep going through this? Why do we not seem to make progress in this area? Well, one of my colleagues has a very useful aphorism that I think he filched from Hegel, actually, to the effect that nothing that is regular is stupid. Okay? If it is regular, it may seem stupid, but it's not, because most of the time people aren't all that stupid. They may look stupid, but they usually aren't. And so if you see a pattern recurring, there's probably a reason for it. And if you don't understand it, if you can't explain it, if it looks stupid, that's probably because you just don't understand the dynamics behind it. Okay? And then I found a lovely quote, which I shall read you to make sure I get it right, if I can find my notes. This I have sourced to the Edinburgh Review of 1843. I haven't been able to confirm that source yet. I got it out of an in-flight magazine on the airplane. And it says, "In the pure and physical sciences, each generation inherits the conquests made by its predecessors." That's Newton and the shoulders of giants, you remember. "But in the moral sciences," and that's why I think it's authentic, we don't write like that anymore, moral sciences, lovely phrase, "particularly the arts of administration, the ground seems never to be incontestably won." In other words, you do have to keep doing it over again. Okay? And they noticed that back in Edinburgh in the 1840s. And that probably wasn't the first time they'd said it either. So if this is a phenomenon which is broader and more general than our particular circumstances, then we should be looking for broader and more general explanations. All right? We shouldn't be looking for the explanation solely in our own circumstances. Although, when we find useful insights, we certainly want to bring them back and see whether they help us in our own circumstances, when we find insights we think are useful. So that's why I found myself trolling among the work of a chap who was looking at the rate of erosion of topsoil in the highlands of the Philippines, or the conflicts between Bengali settlers and the local people in Assam, or water rights in the Middle East, trying to draw general stories from that that might apply in other areas of conflict. Now, Tad Homer Dixon's work, and I hope that sometime he'll be able to take up an invitation from this group to come and talk to you directly. Right now you're getting the kind of potted Coles Notes version. I have tried these sorts of things out when he was in the room, and he didn't sort of react violently, so I suppose that's probably all right. Goes back to some of the old challenge and response traditions in historiography. It takes off from the notion that human environments tend to degrade over time, that basically things get worse. It's very pessimistic in that respect. But that we respond to that by the application of ingenuity of various sorts, technical ingenuity, gadgetry, the engineers and the scientists, but also, very importantly, social ingenuity, finding institutional adaptations, changes in our political systems, changes in our economic arrangements that enable us to cope with the changes in our environments and indeed to continue to progress, even though the purely external world has a tendency to get worse on us. Okay? Now that kind of tension between human ingenuity as a positive force, most of the time, and the inherent tendency for things to get worse on the other side, that kind of tension shows up in a couple, of, well, no, I shouldn't say a couple, tends to be used in two polar approaches to the evolution of societies, one of which you might call the Neo-Malthusians, and he does, and the other you might call the naive neoclassical economics optimists. That's a bit of a mouthful, but economists tend to be sort of, despite the fact that everybody else thinks they're dismal, economists tend to think of themselves in optimistic terms. It may be because they know what the alternatives are. The Neo-Malthusians focus on population growth and the mining out or the decline in the availability of non-renewable resources. And it's non-renewable is really important. And their basic, you see this coming up in the limits to growth literature that it was important about 20 years ago, and it's still with us in the sort of the tree hugger environment. My wife particularly likes the bumper sticker that says, you know, hug a logger, you'll never go back to trees. The general idea is that no matter how much ingenuity you bring to bear as a community, eventually the combination of population growth and decline in resources gets ahead of you. There are limits to your growth, and those limits will be binding. There's nothing you can do about it. And that's really that's why it's Neo-Malthusian. The optimistic economic, neoclassical economic, on the other hand, essentially assumes a kind of continuous supply of ingenuity. It says there'll always be enough ingenuity to get you around any of your blockages. And the people who sort of support that school point to the fact that the real price of resources, most resources, doesn't seem to rise over time. That if we were really being constrained by ultimate shortages of resources, we should find resources getting more costly over time. And you do see the sort of sudden, you know, run up in oil prices, but then it goes back down again. You know, we figure out our way around that particular blockage. So you've got these two polar views, one of which essentially says ingenuity will never get you out of the trap, and the other of which says you don't need to worry about it. There's always going to be ingenuity there, that it'll take place by itself. And what Homer Dixon is doing is he's sort of going up the middle on this, and he's saying, well, first of all, there's no guarantee that the ingenuity will be there, but secondly, what you got to think about is not so much the problem of running out of non-renewable resources, it's the renewable resources that get you into trouble. Why? Because the renewable resources are made available through really quite complex combinations of interactions with the environment, and those interactions with the environment have both positive and negative feedback loops in them, or in simple terms, you can get into bad trouble before you know it and have a lot of difficulty getting out of it again. Whereas the non-renewable resources tend to be simpler. As you start to mine out your coal, the price of coal goes up and people think of substitutes for it, or they think of ways of, other sources of energy, or there's a negative feedback loop that gets you off the hook. But in the renewable resources, your problems tend to be more complicated, and the necessary responses, and this is a critical part of his story, the necessary responses tend to be social ingenuity as much as technical ingenuity. Finding the appropriate institutions for managing your environment so that you sort of say, well, you know, that the difficulty is not so much trying to figure out what to do about the fisheries. I mean, we've had Tony Scott and Peter Pierce telling us what to do about that for years. There's no reason to believe they're wrong. The problem is we can't seem to find the appropriate political environment to apply the knowledge that we've already got. And that seems to be the constraint. The social ingenuity is the difficult part, not the technical. So from that perspective, you get a model which focuses your attention on the kinds of social structures which will best induce the necessary flows of ingenuity to keep you progressing. And then you start to look at the flip side of that, which is when your environment deteriorates, does your society mobilize more ingenuity, or does it fragment and do people start fighting among themselves? Are there lines of cleavage in your society that begin to open up when it's under pressure? And if they do, then you find, first of all, your supply of ingenuity tends to dry up, but to the extent that it's still there, it tends to be devoted toward fighting with each other rather than figuring out what to do with the common problem. And your overall environment gets worse as you fight among yourselves. So the Homer Dixon's model is a way of trying to understand how communal conflict is generated within a state as opposed to conflicts among states, and how that's linked to the need to develop the difficulty of developing the appropriate social institutions for dealing with deterioration in your external environment. I've given it a very, as I said, that really is the Coles Notes version, and there's a lot more on that could be and should be said. But that's about where I'm going to leave it now, except to give you a chart which is authentic. It should give you some idea of the flavor of this sort of story. Okay? And you've got on the left-hand side basic factors tending to lead towards deterioration of your environment. All right? Your renewable resources availability going down, population growth going up. If you also have more unequal access to resources, then you've got more severe problems feeding into conflict. Increased scarcity of renewable resources, conflict leading to migration or expulsion of people, falling off productivity, weakened states, state apparatus having less room to maneuver, ethnic conflicts, well, you can read it better than I can, all right? Now, I want to leave that on because while you might say, well, this looks okay for Somalia or Bosnia or West Africa or Rwanda or something of that sort, what on earth does it have to do with a modern developed society? Well, the dimensions of this are a little different, obviously. Start with the coup d'etat. As far as I know, nobody's threatening to send tanks down to 700 Hamilton Street and take over the CBC. Now, we may not have a CBC that much longer, which might be much the same sort of thing, but we don't go through that process. On the other hand, if you soften that down to violent swings in political philosophy, personnel, policies, is there that much difference between Mike Harris and a coup d'etat? Well, yes, there is, because nobody gets shot. I mean, and that is a big difference. But in terms of the dramatic change in political focus, maybe not so much. And what we're seeing in Canada and in the United States and in Britain is we're seeing this kind of more dramatic fluctuation in your political environment. You're seeing much weaker states. You're seeing the states burdened by debt, constrained by angry taxpayers, locked in by foreign investors. You're seeing, particularly again in Canada, a lot of rhetoric about weakened states. Are we seeing conflict over among ethnic groups and increasing pressure on migrants and kick out the foreigners and all that kind of stuff? Well, yes, we are. Again, depending on which state you're talking about. Less of it in Canada, more of it in California, some distinct ugliness in Germany. You know, again, not a complete story of any one country, but a set of tendencies that suggest that the model is not a precise representation of what goes on in the developed world. Definitely not. But on the other hand, some of the same forces seeming to be at work. The same fundamental notion of environmental deterioration leading to opening up of lines of fracture, of internal conflict rather than figuring out what to do about the problem, okay? Of, you know, again, the old phrase, we would be well to hang together because otherwise we shall certainly hang separately. Well, folks being prepared to take their risks on hanging separately. Now, having said all that, is that all I needed to get out of this? Let me just summarize that then. So the story is a deteriorating environment which can be, if you're lucky, compensated for by, you know, if you're lucky, if you're well organized, compensated for by human ingenuity. And the human ingenuity comes, whoa, there we go again. Thank you. And the human ingenuity comes both in the technical and particularly in the social domain. But the process of mobilizing ingenuity can be interfered with, short-circuited by the development of the opening up of fracture lines and the development of what are sometimes called in the trade narrowly based interest coalitions. Small groups, smaller interest groups that figure they can come out ahead even though the overall situation may deteriorate. The phrase making out like bandits comes to mind. And that whole process then leads to general decline. So prosperity and decline both seem to feed on each other. Again, we're dealing with positive feedback loops. And that's the kind of story that I want to then take into the process of thinking about healthcare reform. Okay. Now, what's all this about the deteriorating environment? Well, let's switch over to Canada and think a little bit about that. See if I can find my various notes here. There we go. This is kind of a neat one. This is one of those transparencies that's so obvious, you sort of feel embarrassed when you sort of thought of doing it afterwards, but not embarrassed enough not to put it on the screen. That's real income, real output, i.e. adjusted for inflation, per capita in Canada since the war, okay? And what you can see is that over most of that period, the boxes are the actual levels and the curved line is simply a logarithmic trend that I fitted to the data. Now, I only fitted the trend from 1947 to 1980 and then I projected it for the rest of the period. So what that's telling you is what happened in the 1980s relative to the previous growth trend. It's not fitted over the whole period. And what you can see there quite clearly is the recession of the early 80s, and you can see that we never really came out of that, and then you can see the wheels really coming off in the late 80s. Okay? And so all the folks who tell you that we've gone through a recovery, it's a little hard to find in those data. Okay? That, to me, is a quite dramatic decline in your external environment. And it corresponds, of course, to the period of rising unemployment rates, rising deficits, rising payments for unemployment insurance, rising payments for welfare. All of that correlates very nicely with, not precisely, but very nicely, with the general collapse in the overall economy. Well, collapse, that's too strong a word. With the sort of stagnation in the overall economy. And it's really quite simple and quite straightforward. And the so-called recovery of the mid-80s was not a recovery to previous levels. As you see, it runs parallel, but it doesn't actually get back. And it doesn't get back to the previous growth path, and that corresponds to not getting back to previous levels of government, relatively low government deficits or relatively low rates of unemployment, and so on. Now, just to take those same data and recast them to make it a bit more dramatic. This is sort of painting pictures with statistics. That's the same data again, only now we have it relative to trend. Okay? So you can see the ratio of the actual to the trend value over that whole period. And you can really see how dramatically we fell off the end. And you can see that the recovery of the 1980s, relative to our long-run growth path, the recovery of the 1980s is on a level which in the 50s we called the Diefenbaker recession. Some of you probably remember that period. And the recovery of the present time is basically we've stopped falling. Okay? Well, that's good. I mean, you know, consider the alternative. Now, if you fit that trend only since 1960, which is of relevance because our healthcare system began to take on its present form in about 1960. We had universal hospital coverage starting in 1960, and the first of the universal medical care plans went in 62 in Saskatchewan. You get an even tighter fit around the trend, and you get an even sharper collapse. You know, this is again, there's an element of not lying with statistics, but creating impressions with statistics here. I'm doing this in a way to create a gee whiz chart, but the numbers are what they are. I wanted to counterpoint that with this. I think this is kind of cute. Whoops. Yes, well, that's a counterpoint. Look, I'm in the Faculty of Arts. I don't handle this technology really well. Okay. Now that's from the Globe and Mail in 1990. Okay. Now you recall the previous charts? Yeah. Well, it's all a matter of perceptions. Now, he's not wholly wrong. The mid-80s, that level of income was higher than previous levels, okay? But it was way below what the trend had been. So if you think about people's expectations and you think about previous growth paths and where people expected to be, we were way off. But strictly speaking, yes, it was, you know, income per capita on average was higher than it had been in the previous years. It's not till very recently that it started to go into the tank and actually falling. Now, what's that got to do with healthcare? Well, here's another gee whiz slide. Okay? I'm going to unbundle this in a minute, but that's what was going on at the same time in the healthcare system. Now, I put that up there because as background to the discussion of healthcare reform, one of the things you've got going on is exploding costs. Well, there's exploding cost for you. Now, warn you, one of the ways you do that is, you'll notice I switched from landscape to portrait mode. This slide is standing on its end, okay? So I've scrunched in the horizontal axis. Simple as that, and you get a cost explosion. If I'd put it on the other axis, it wouldn't look nearly as dramatic. People do this all the time. It's part of the game. They don't usually tell you. Also, although that's per capita and real, okay, so I've adjusted it for population and I've adjusted it for inflation, I haven't adjusted it for what's going on in the general economy. Okay? And when the economy is growing, typically the people who work in the healthcare sector expect to participate in that growth and feel a little bit cheesed off if they don't, and that has something to do with your overall cost. You'll notice there are really only about 2 points where you actually get this thing slowed down. See if I can make that work. One of them is right there in the 70s, okay? There was a flat spot in the late 70s, and the other is right now. But again, behind all the rhetoric of cutbacks and collapsing system and, you know, the whole thing is going to hell in a handbasket, actually, the level of real resources per capita, at least down to 93, and that's an important qualification, was continuing to grow. Just wasn't growing as fast, that's all. Okay. So again, that's background to the reform process. But does that mean that people were making this whole thing up? Well, no, not really, because this is kind of neat. Have I got it upside down again? Yep. I'll get there. I keep trying to look at it from your point of view. Always a mistake, really. That's the share of national income going to healthcare in the black boxes The dotted line at the bottom is what it would have been if we'd stayed on our previous growth path. Okay? So the people in the system who think that it's relatively static are, I think, I hypothesize, looking at it from that point of view. They're saying, relative to our expectations, past trends, what we perceive as the changes in technology, you know, the litany, the aging of the population, the popular expectations, growth of technology, blah, 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 mostly nonsense, but never mind. That's what everybody believes, so that becomes general beliefs are facts. They're just wrong facts, that's all. That looks pretty restrained. That's really saying, what's wrong here is nothing wrong with the healthcare system. We just got to get a new economy.
Well, yeah.
And Mark Baltzone at the Canadian Medical Association once came out and said exactly that. And that's basically what that chart says. Okay? So that it can explain a certain amount of cognitive dissonance, of failure to communicate between the people in the ministries of finance. Just to put that, I'll put another similar one on in a minute. The people in the ministries of finance who are dealing with the upper line and saying, that's what's happening to the overall share, and the people who are in the healthcare system and are saying, but we're being really restrained. You know, we're being much more careful than we used to be. And so you get, you know, Jack Armstrong at the Canadian Medical Association quoted, what, last week, week before, in the Medical Post saying, our system is cut to the bone. Actually, that cut to the bone rhetoric first emerged in the mid-70s, I think. You remember there was a flat spot in the 70s in that curve? That's when I first remember hearing people talking about cut to the bone. Anyway, it's cut to the bone again, so there we go. This one is only hospitals and doctors. Two reasons for that. One, they're covered by the Medicare plan. But two, you can get the data all the way back to the war. And that's the one where you can show the dramatic expansion during the pre-Medicare years, the flat spot in the Medicare years, and if the growth in the economy had continued, we'd now be seeing significant decline. If the actual expenditures had been what they in fact were in healthcare, but the economy had stayed on its previous growth path, you'd have got a ratio like that. So this is sort of the impact, coming back to my Homer Dixon theme, this is the impact of deterioration in the overall economic environment translated through to the healthcare system. Okay? This is the kind of opening up of the gap, if you like, between what the people in healthcare had come to expect, thought was appropriate in terms of meeting expanding needs, and what was going on in the rest of the economy in terms of capacity to pay. Okay? Or, I shouldn't say capacity, that was a slip. I could lose my economist card for that. Willingness to pay. We could pay lots more if we wanted to. But collectively, we seem to be saying we don't want to. The Americans do. They keep saying they don't want to either. But they have a remarkable lack of ingenuity in their social arrangements. There's also a problem of shares. This is kind of neat. Again, I want to show you some sort of dramatic tricks with statistics. This is the same period, well, the 60, post-60 period, hospitals, drugs, and doctors. Okay? Now keep your eye on that bottom line, which is prescription drugs. And you can see it seems to be moving up relative to doctors and hospitals quite fast, but it's still the bottom line on the chart. You know, that's if you're quick with numbers, you can see there's something pretty weird going on there. But if you're just kind of quickly looking at a chart, it's the bottom line, it's not the big numbers. Now, if I simply take hospitals off that chart, okay, all I do is I take hospitals off, my program, my little spreadsheet program automatically draws charts, automatically fits the scale for me, and that's what comes off. I knock off one series and bingo. Now that's a gee whiz chart. That's for trying to get your attention, okay? And what that says is that expenditure on drugs relative to the overall economy has nearly tripled since the mid-70s. And if you want to know why the province of BC is trying to set up a reference-based pricing system, or if you want to know why private employers in Toronto are getting interested in what are called pharmaceutical benefits management companies, i.e. private firms who will come in and tell you how to slash your drug budget. That's why, right there. Now, there's again, as always, there's lots more that you could say, and, you know, if you're not careful, I will. But that's the overall picture. Okay? So that's my story about a deteriorating economic environment for the Canadian healthcare system, fitting into Homer Dixon's story about what happens there when you allow your lines of fracture to open up. Now, if you've been following the argument so far, however, you will say, wait a minute, you told us all about fractionation, opening up lines of fracture, of divisions and conflict within the society, and all you've shown so far is aggregate numbers. And that's true. I haven't shown you anything at all about distribution. All I've said is the overall situation's gotten worse. Now, what do we know about distribution? Well, turns out we do know a little bit about what's happening to the distribution of well-being and of incomes and so on in our society. And a lot of the work here has been done by Michael Wolfson at Statistics Canada, who is also a member of the CIR program. You've got to go out and get people like that because they actually know the numbers. Saves an awful lot of time. Michael's written a paper on this, on the question of, is income in Canada becoming more unequal with this overall deterioration in our environment? And the title of the paper is a very Canadian one. It is Stasis Amid Change. And the conclusion is likewise very Canadian. It is yes and no. But both the yes and the no are extremely important. The no, and the backdrop to this, those of you who actually get any of your television or read any magazines or anything like that from the United States, which of course most people don't, will know that there's a tremendous amount of stuff turns up there about the vanishing middle class and the increase in the income shares of the wealthy and the increasing numbers of people in poverty, and just the middle band is disappearing. And it probably is. That is and is not happening in Canada, okay? When you look at the numbers, family incomes, the distribution of family incomes doesn't seem to have changed much in decades. The bottom 20% of families pick up about 4% of the total income. The top 20% pick up about 40%. There's quite a lot of inequality. There's not as much as in the US, not as much as in the UK, much more than in Scandinavia. The point is that it isn't changing much, okay? So whether you're against it or for it, it's not widening dramatically. In fact, it's not widening at all. But when you look at labor incomes, you find that they are becoming much more unequal, okay? So the market in Canada is producing more and more inequality in incomes. So why isn't that feeding through into the overall data? Because the system of transfers and of various other social programs that we have in Canada is effectively offsetting the impact of a more and more inegalitarian market. So to recap that part of the story, as the overall economic environment has deteriorated, the marketplace is generating the same pressures towards more inequality in income as it is in the States, but the difference in the social program systems, the tax and transfer system, is so far buffering virtually all of that change. And I will quote directly from Michael Wolfson on this, because I think that's probably the best summary, that rather than doing it myself. So he looks at the distribution of disposable income, i.e. the money you have after you've paid your taxes and after you've received whatever benefits you get from government. And he says, the actions of government tax transfer policies, the actions of government tax transfer policies have essentially offset the trends in market income inequality. Okay? Now, that should show up, and does, in a substantial increase in the share of income coming from transfer payments. And it does. According to Michael, in 1967, transfers, i.e. things like old age pension, you know, unemployment insurance, workers' compensation benefits, welfare, all that kind of stuff that you get but didn't work directly for, those kinds of transfer payments amounted to 6.6% of income. in 1967. By 1993, they're up to 14%. Okay? So transfers have become a significantly larger part of income in Canada. And if you look at the distribution of those, people in the lowest 20% of incomes get about 2/3 of their income from transfers. Okay? People in the next 20% get about 40% from transfers, and people in the top quintile, the top 20%, get about 3% of their income from transfers. In other words, what you've got is a social redistribution system that is so far offsetting the economic impact of increased inequality that appears to be associated with general economic decline. All right? Now, that's relevant to healthcare because although these numbers refer to the redistribution of incomes, it also applies to the redistribution of benefit programs like health, and less clear for education, where again, the distribution of access would be becoming substantially more unequal if it were not for the social framework that we have. Now, you can look at that in two ways, and this is where it feeds into the reform process. On the one hand, you can say, that's what the social programs were supposed to do. They were supposed to serve as a safety net, but more than that, as a way of buffering the inequality that was generated by markets. But if you turn that coin over, you can say the kind of the sort of the work being done by those programs is increasing over time. That more and more is going, more and more money is being moved around by those programs because the market is generating more inequality, and the public programs are having to move more money to offset that inequality, from which it follows that if you can mount a successful attack on those programs, you can make a lot more out of it. In other words, there's a lot more money to be made now than there used to be by wrecking our social system, okay? If you happen to be at the payer end rather than the payee end, okay? They're two sides of the same coin. So that, again, when you look at the social program reform process, you can look at it either way. You can look at it in terms of the potential gains to organizing narrow interest-based coalitions to overturn those transfers, or you can look at it from the point of view of how much work is being done by those transfers in moving money around. And they're, you know, both are happening at exactly the same time, because they're really both parts of the same thing. Okay, so that's sort of the inequality side. Now, the announced topic was healthcare reform. But we had to put the preconditions in place. When we move from transfer payments to what are called exhaustive programs, of which healthcare is the biggest, we have introduced one more complexity. Okay? Transfer programs, the ones that I've been talking about that just move money around, are conceptually simple. What they amount to doing is taking money out of one person's pocket and putting it into another. All right? We tax one group and we give the money to another. And we don't actually interfere with the market particularly. We just take the money from one pocket, put it into another, and then people go out and spend it as they see fit. Now, there's a little more to the story than that. There are some overhead costs associated with running those programs. And there are economists who can create the most extraordinary superstructures of costs associated with those programs that really do depend on the eye of faith. But then economics is basically religion carried on by other means anyway, as von Clausewitz said about war. But for the exhaustive programs, it's a good bit more involved because what economists mean by exhaustive is they actually use up resources. The transfer programs don't. They don't use up any resources. They simply, well, except for the odd civil servant to run them. They take money, they take the command over resources from one person and give it to another, but they don't actually use up the resources themselves. When you set up a health care program and include that in your social program bundle, you're actually using up the resources of human time and energy and the physical capital and so on that go into producing health care. And that means that you're also paying incomes to the people who actually deliver the service. So you now have three groups involved. You have the payers, you have the recipients, and you have the suppliers. Whereas with a straight transfer program, you've got the payers and the recipients, and that's it. But with an exhaustive program, you've got the three parties. And that means you've got a somewhat more complex relationship. And it looks rather like this. Again, I've thrown in a few simplifications here, which will be known, I hope, to anybody who's up on their national income accounting. But basically, what this says is that if you think about a healthcare system, you can think about it as a flow through three different nodes. Okay, now government and other insurers are sort of consolidated together here, in which the people who produce the care supply it to members of households. Households supply the resources with which the care is produced. So those arrows represent the exhaustive use of resources. Those are the households provide the services of the people who work in the healthcare sector, and those are then combined and sent back as services. And so that's the kind of real exchange that takes place between providers and users and owners of services. But the financing mechanism involves three different channels. It involves the taxes that go into government. It involves premiums to provide to private insurers, if there are any. It involves direct charges. And they flow then into providers as payment, and then they go back to households as income. And that cycle, every stage in that cycle has to remain in balance. Okay? If one of those arrows is left out, it means money is collecting somewhere under somebody's bed or being spirited out into the Cayman Islands or something like that, or else people are just not doing their sums right. So out of that, you get a three-part identity that says that the total expenditures on healthcare must equal the total incomes of the people who work in the sector, and it must equal the total revenues that are raised to pay for it. All three of those have to stay in balance. But that doesn't tell you who the beneficiaries are going to be, and it doesn't tell you the balance of profit and loss. Okay? So this is where all the stuff we've been developing up to now comes down to the sharp end of profit and loss, because it says if you've got a deteriorating economic environment, if you've got the opening up of fissures and fracture lines in your society such that you've got more internal conflict, that will be focused on social programs that simply transfer money around, and we know that that's happening. But it will also be focused on your health care system or your other exhaustive programs, because they likewise transfer money around. But they transfer it along three different axes. There's the one axis of who pays, there's the axis of who gets paid, and there's the axis of who gets served. And all three of these axes generate conflict, and all three of those conflict axes are involved in all of our debates over health reform. Okay? So your first axis, the easiest one to see, is the conflict between those who pay and those who get paid. And I mentioned reference pricing system for drugs in BC. That's a perfectly straightforward system that, if it works, is designed to take money away from the shareholders of drug companies and reduce the burden on BC taxpayers. Pure and simple. Okay? It's a transfer of money from those who get paid to those who have to do the pay. And needless to say, there's a lot of conflict along that axis. The one we usually hear about in the newspapers is the conflict between medical associations and governments fighting over fee schedules. That's one of the very common ones. But of course, lying behind the whole labor accord in the hospital sector is again a conflict between those who get paid, who are the people who have been working in hospitals that are now being closed down or being shrunken, and the government on behalf of the taxpayer who pay them. So that the expenditure has to equal income, and there's always going to be a conflict along that axis between the folks who provide the services and who would like to see more spent, and the folks who pay for the services and would like to spend less. They'd like to get the services for less money, obviously, and the guys who supply them would like to get paid more money. So that gives you one basic axis of conflict. And if you have a government which has said, the feds have said very clearly in their last budget, and so far they haven't backed away from it, the feds have said we're pulling $7 billion out of the transfers to the provinces for health and education. Okay? There's going to be less. We're pulling it out. Two things are possible. One, they will. Two, they won't. Okay? On the whole, the probabilities are they will, and maybe more afterwards. If they do, the provinces could react by making up the difference. Provinces could raise their taxes. I won't ask hands up all those who think that's going to happen. They could go further into debt. Again, I won't do the poll. Or they can cut the amount of money they pay. Okay? So those factors, if you think about that chart, are saying that the amount of money flowing through that top pair of pipes down to providers looks like it's going down. It's certainly not going up. That means provider incomes are going to be lower. Or they've got to open up other channels of funding. Okay? One or the other. Very simple. And that's where all the debate over two-tier privatization, core services, that's where that all springs from. Now, there's an awful lot of superstructure of rhetoric about waiting lists and unmet needs on the one hand and inefficiency and inappropriate servicing on the other hand. But beneath that layer of rhetoric, the fundamental accounting identity is if the government has put a lid on what it's paying, then either the incomes are going down or they've got to open up private channels. Now, the really sneaky way of opening up private channels is to try to get back private insurance, because private insurance in Canada for health care, you think of your drug benefit plans, you think of your dental plans, you think of extended health benefit, all of that is subsidized through the income tax. Economists long ago started talking about tax expenditures because they realized that governments can subsidize an activity either by direct payment or providing tax breaks. And it comes to much the same thing. One takes it off one side of the budget, one takes it off the other, but it's basically the same effect. The difference, of course, is political. People see subsidies when it's direct expenditure. Most people aren't aware of subsidies that take the form of tax breaks. Okay? But it amounts to much the same thing. When in the last budget there was a trial balloon about taking away the tax benefits of private insurance, the Canadian Dental Association raised a war chest of $1 million and ran a campaign all over the country saying, don't take away this exemption. Like any other industry, they didn't want to lose a government subsidy. So if you bring back private insurance and you do it in the same pattern that medical insurance is already established in this country, then you get more government money in through the back door. And you can get quite a substantial amount in. You'll get more in for wealthy people than for poor people, because of course the value of a tax break is greater when you're in a higher tax bracket. So that's kind of cunning. And of course that is part of the argument over private care, is can we find a way of getting private insurance in as well, which is a way of tapping the public treasury, which every private businessman always wants to do. Nobody out there really wants to operate in the private competitive market. That's some kind of dream of economists, most of whom have tenure at universities. I once did run a peanut stand for a day and made a profit, but it was only one day. So that's one principal axis of conflict. And as I say, the question of whether the services are whether we're paying too much. Jean Chrétien says, why can't we get by with 8 to 9% of our GDP the way the rest of Europe does? Why do we have to spend over 10? Armstrong at the CMA says, well, no, we're not paying over 10 anymore. The most recent numbers are below that. Well, they may be. I don't know where he's gotten them from. But anyway, he's sure they're down at 9. You know, that kind of argument about we need more, we need less. Those arguments have been going on for 20 years, and they aren't going to change. But they contaminate the process of mobilizing ingenuity to learn how to figure out how to operate in a more restricted environment. The message that came out of the Royal Commissions all across the country, and the BC Royal Commission, it was put very nicely by one of the commissioners, David Sinclair, would be a partner in Coopers and Lybrand, came back and said, this system doesn't need more money, it needs more management. Okay? Well, that's right, I think. Certainly we all signed that. What exactly does it mean? Well, we're not sure. We know what it means in general terms, but the specifics involve an awful lot of very hard work by somebody else, because your commissioners were finished with their job. It's nice, that. But it certainly pointed the direction, okay? And the conflicts that you're getting between payers and payees create a high level of noise and confusion that makes it difficult to focus on that activity. You see me coming back to Homer Dixon's model. Communal violence makes it difficult to figure out how to improve the quality of your water supply. Now, I mentioned that there were three axes of conflict. That's one of them. The second axis of conflict is entirely on the left, looking at it from your point of view again, on the left-hand side, taxes, premiums, and charges. Okay? That is a conflict among the different payers. Economists have a bad habit of using what are called single-sector models that amount to assuming that everybody's identical. You think, well, anyway, enough said on that subject. It should not be rocket science to reflect upon the fact that if you fund a healthcare system through taxes, in general, taxes are collected from people more or less in proportion to their incomes. This has been studied, and it turns out to be true, but it shouldn't be very surprising because tax gatherers are not dumb either, and they don't spend a lot of time trying to collect money from people who don't have any. So a publicly funded system will tend to draw, whatever the level of expenditure is, more of it will come from people with more income. A privately funded system, whether it be funded through private insurance or whether it be funded through private charges, will take more money from people at lower incomes. Why? Because the income is the money is taken according to whether you use care, and that's dependent on whether you or not you happen to be sick. And if there's any correlation of that with income, it's negative. You know, on the whole, poorer people tend to be sicker. But there is certainly not the strong positive correlation that there is between income and taxable liability. So that the more you shift the funding mechanisms toward public funding, the more you shift the costs onto the shoulders of people who are relatively high income, the wealthy. I've just used that as a catchphrase, not just the wealthy, it's all of us, but it's proportionate to income. And you pick up the people who are healthy. If you push the funding mechanisms the other way, if you bring back more private charges, you shift it down onto the people who are less wealthy and less healthy. Okay? So there's a clear trade-off between the sort of the unhealthy and unwealthy at one end and the healthy and wealthy at the other end. So that axis of conflict then can line up with the conflict between providers and payers, because you'll notice that the providers in our type of system, not generally, not necessarily true, not a priori true, but in our type of system with a solid clamp on public payments and every expectation that they're going to go down, certainly not going up, under those circumstances there's a very powerful incentive for providers to tap private money, and that lines up directly with the interests of people who are relatively wealthy and relatively healthy, because they too will be better off if you move into more private funding. On the other hand, people who are unhealthy and unwealthy will be worse off. So that's the second axis. The third axis is trickier. That has to do with access. That has to do with, so all right, you happen not to be healthy, now what? And that's where you start thinking about, well, who gets care? The previous two were all financial issues. This is actually a who gets healthcare issue, and that tends to bring it closer to home. And under that line, you then see the conflict between the folks who think they would make out better if they had the opportunity to purchase care when they needed it, and basically to purchase their way to the head of a queue, and the folks who think that they don't have the resources, so if there's a squeeze, they're the ones who are likely to get squeezed out. So there's a clear conflict along that axis, but it is fundamentally driven by perception, as we found all the way through this discussion, perception of what you think the adequacy of the existing system is. So if you think the existing system is grossly inadequate, or liable to be, if you buy the story that says cutting the funds available is going to cause a catastrophe, there just isn't going to be enough for everybody, we've got to find more funding somehow, which is definitely the provider's view because that's their incomes, then you as a relatively wealthy user might very well say, my gosh, I got to make sure that whatever's available, I get first crack, because my health, maybe even my life, is going to be dependent on it. So I want to open up other channels. On the other hand, if you either think that you won't have the resources for that, or you think, look, there isn't a shortage. This is not a fundamental problem of shortage. There's a whole lot of money already in this system, and every one of these royal commissions kept saying the system doesn't need more money. They didn't address less. They didn't address what happens if they pull out $7 billion. But if you have confidence that that can be taken out, and by golly, a lot has gone out in the last little while with dramatic declines in hospital utilization and no effect whatever on anybody's health, at least none that anybody can find. If you believe that, then you don't buy that story. But I think there's a lot of evidence that you could bring to bear on this. I have a position on it, obviously. That's not relevant for tonight. The thing that is relevant for tonight is the way in which there is an inevitable structural conflict. It is structural, it is built in, and that's why those same issues keep coming back and back and back decade after decade, is because this structure is given, that doesn't change, And this structure builds in certain fundamental conflicts along those three axes that I've mentioned. And then when you get into a situation, as we are at the moment, when your external environment, your economic environment in this case, does deteriorate, how do you mobilize the ingenuity to deal with that rather than dissipating your effort along those structural fault lines, those structural conflict lines? And that seems to me to be what we're wrestling with at the moment. And I can give you a couple, and I will quit, I'll give you just a couple of examples that I think are relevant to this. And they illustrate a problem of sort of the conversation of the deaf. There is a thing going on now. There is a sort of movement called the evidence-based medicine movement. And I don't think it was entirely caused by McMaster University, but they had a lot to do with it, and David Sackett and his friends, which says basically, you really ought to go out and look at medical care, find out whether the things that are being done work or not. If they really work, you should do them, and maybe even more. And if they don't work, you should stop. Radical. A bizarre idea. Okay? It's been extended to the evidence-based decision-making movement, which said, why should we restrict that idea only to medicine, only to the activities of doctors? Maybe we should have that notion all the way through our healthcare system. I mean, now you're getting really weird. The key story there is, if it doesn't work, don't do it. But the trouble is, if you don't do it, somebody's not going to get paid for it. Okay? And that means somebody's not going to have an income. Okay? So the contrary, or not the contrary, the sort of side conversation, which sounds the same but is in fact different, is the so-called core services notion idea that says, what we ought to do is we ought to define a core of services for the public system, and that'll be all the services that are sufficiently effective and important and so on, and the public will provide them, and then the private market will provide, fill in the blank, all the stuff that doesn't work. All the stuff that's not as important, all the stuff that's more discretionary, all the stuff that, well, it gets a little fuzzy there, but the point is that the first story, evidence-based, the emphasis is on, if it doesn't work, stop. And that means lower cost. The second one is, get it out from under the public system. Keep paying the same amount for the public services, but draw in more funds, open up that new channel, get in more money. That's a solution to an income shortage. Okay? And those two conversations go straight past each other. The people who are using one form of rhetoric simply don't meet the people who are using the other form. I'm not sure why they just don't go to the same con. Well, they do. I saw a couple of them on a panel once this summer. And the conversation was not joined. One person made one presentation, the next person got up and made the next presentation. It was pretty clear they were radically inconsistent with each other, but that didn't bother anybody. And then we went and had coffee. So the general problem then is that somehow we've got to find the appropriate structures or maintain the appropriate structures for focusing our collective attention on dealing in a rational and an informed way with the kind of very real pressures that we're now under. And we've got to do that in an environment which is increasingly contaminated by this sort of racket from the opening up, or the creaking, as it were, of the opening up of these fault lines, as we see the same old arguments coming back from this now more stressed environment. And that's basically, I think, where we are, and that's where I'm going to stop.
Bob, do you want to get another question? Sure. You don't want to get another one. No, you want me to repeat the question?
Okay. Now, John, do you want to give me a hand on picking those out? I am quite happy to take questions, but the chance of my seeing them is relatively low. I can deal very well with the front row here, so I've asked John to pick up the questions for me. And you bet. Sorry? No. Bypass surgery, there are clear examples, particularly with 3- and 4-vessel surgery, where it actually does work. But the randomized trials for ultrasound in routine pregnancy show no benefit whatever. Electronic fetal monitoring, same story. a lot of the work that's being done up on the fourth floor here by the BC Office of Technology Assessment. Again, finding the things that the evidence is not there for it working. Mammography for women under 50. You know? Again, the evidence from the randomized trials is doesn't do any good. Okay? So yeah, now, you did throw in, however, general agreement. Okay? And that's the tough part, because you can get agreement by the people who think that the randomized trial is an appropriate way of testing it. But then you get other people who sort of say, well, never mind all that stuff. You know, I just know what I'm doing is right. And it's hard to deal with that. There are some examples. The classic one that's frequently cited is ECIC, extracranial intracranial bypass. That was where the neurosurgeons figured they had the answer to the cardiac surgeons that you could avoid transient ischemic attacks and strokes by revascularizing the brain, and it involved boring a hole in the side of the head and sort of putting in a pipe graft in there that would supply extra blood. And that all sounded pretty logical and pretty intuitively. The only trouble is when they did the randomized trial, the people who had the procedure came out worse than the people who didn't, and it pretty much stopped being done. So where you can show you're actually killing folks, you usually get a result. Folks, they stop. But it's difficult to understand what goes on in the industry when you get these kinds of results from your randomized trials and people just walk past them and you sort of, well, my patients are different. What do I draw for it? The question was, I beg your pardon, I didn't do that with Eric's either. The question was, I showed a graph which showed a dramatic increase in expenditure on drugs over the last 20 years. What policy implications do I draw from that? Well, the first thing I would, and I hate to admit this, it's very painful, I'm going to do it anyway, I can't see a bounce in that curve corresponding to the Mulroney government's introduction of the extended patent protection. You know, now I'm in the same box as Eric's clinicians. I mean, I know that's got to have been really important, but it doesn't show up in those data. It doesn't show up. Okay, but what policy implications do I draw from that? Well, two things. One is what we're seeing now: a lot more aggressive negotiation over drug prices. But secondly, a lot more careful review of what drugs are being prescribed and who's prescribing them. I mentioned the private sector drug benefit management firms. They are operating now in the U.S. on contract to private employers who have to pay these drug bills. In 1992 and 93, which are the most recent data that I've got from the U.S., drug costs in the U.S. have actually risen substantially less fast than overall health costs, whereas in Canada they've risen substantially faster. This is attributed by some observers to the activity of these drug benefits management firms who go out and basically tell the drug suppliers, look, if you want us to use your product, you've got to cut your prices. That's all there is to it. If you don't, we won't use it. Meaning our employees may have those prescriptions written for them, but we won't pay for them. Okay. So they're using some fairly heavy muscle to get those prices down. Now, having said that, I've got to warn you that there are other observers who say, no, that decline in U.S. drug costs, it's being attributed to the benefits managers, and they're wallowing in that story because, of course, they're trying to market their services, but actually the drug companies really pulled in their horns on pricing until they got past the Clinton reform package, and once they were sure that the Clinton reforms were completely dead, they're going to push their prices way back up again. The big advantage is we'll know which of those stories is right as soon as we get the 1994 data out of the States. Mm-hmm. If you have, maybe not. Hold on. Sorry, let me let you finish your question. Okay, the question was, it's all very well to say if it doesn't work, don't do it, but you could equally well say if it doesn't work, do something that does work. Okay? And how would you phrase that in economic terms? Well, I wouldn't get to the economics before I got through the epidemiology. It is in general true that if you're doing work in this area, you've got to show effect before it's worth talking about economics. Now, that's not precisely true. There are some wrinkles around that, but it's close enough. And the answer may be there isn't something that works. Or sometimes there is. Again, let me give you an example. One of the most intriguing innovations is it goes under the name of the Ottawa Ankle Rules, and they're being very widely quoted because they've been very, very well handled in the research sets. This was done by some clever beggars in the emergency room at the Ottawa Civic, who are also on staff at Ottawa U. And what they determined after extensive research was that the routine X-ray of ankle injuries in the emergency ward was largely a waste of time. That with a very simple two-part strategy of probing the ankle with the finger and then asking the patient to take four steps, a clinician who knew his job, which doesn't include me, under either count, could tell whether the ankle was broken or not. And on sequences of thousands of patients, they found that they were at least as good as the X-ray. So there was no need to order the X-ray and have everybody wait around and then get the result and then interpret it and then finally tell the patient, no, it's not broken, you can go home. For 30-some-odd percent of all the cases that come in, the answer is you don't need to do that. You do this other thing. Now, that may fit in your category of do something else. Yes, they have a specific maneuver. They do the maneuver, and they get the answer. And it's quick and cheap, and everybody's happy. And the only thing I haven't heard is the reaction of the radiologist. But if you've been following the story so far, you will know that it is only true. It only makes sense to say that this is a cost-saving measure. That statement can only be true if the radiologist's income falls. Otherwise, the statement's false.
Several questions from the back.
Oh, lots. The question was, have you any economic pronouncements on the effectiveness of prevention? First of all, yeah, a whole bunch. First of all, there are certain very specific areas where prevention, we all know, clearly works. And they've been known for years, and that's in the immunization field particularly. But getting people to stop smoking, if you can do it, getting people to buckle their seatbelts. I mean, these are the traditional things that come out over and over again. The reason they're traditional is they're true. The problem is demonstrating economically that they save money. Economists really do deserve the dismal label when they get into this field. And we did, a couple of colleagues and I did a study a lot of years ago now on tobacco smoking. We were all non-smokers, and we wanted to bash the smokers again and bash the tobacco companies by showing not only that they were evil, which they are, but also by showing that they cost us all a lot of money. Unfortunately, the results came out backwards. The tobacco taxes vastly exceeded the amount of health costs generated by smokers. So we published the results anyway. And the contracts did not come in from the tobacco companies. We were not asked to serve as expert witnesses, and we did not all get rich. And it may be because we put something in the article saying they were evil people anyway. But it turns out to be very difficult to show that there are economic benefits from prevention. There are lots of good benefits from being healthy. And you can justify it under those heads. The other thing you've got to watch for is that the kind of thing that Dr. Mustard was talking about last week, a lot of evidence turning up now emphasizing the importance of early life experience for resilience, for the ability to cope with whatever life throws at you in many different dimensions, including health. Okay, that's not nice and tight, but there's a lot of very suggestive evidence out there. The trouble is the healthcare system is increasingly providing its services in a proportionate sense. The proportion provided to the elderly is going up and up. I mean, if you look at what's happening to our, or has happened to our hospital system,
The kids don't use it anymore. People at middle age hardly use it. Most of the care is being provided to people who are over 65. And the point of all that is not that it's necessarily wrong, but that if the main scope of prevention is on the kids and the main use of health care is on the elderly, it's going to be a long time before prevention has any effect. And in fact, the saddest thing of all is probably the cheapest thing you can do is smoke a lot. Don't drink too much. Drinking turns out to be good for you. I mean, talk about divine providence, eh? And have your heart attack on the street. Make sure it's massive. And you're gone.
There was a question right at the back, and then you took it.
Sorry? I refer them to my colleague David. Sorry, I beg your pardon. The question is a powerful one. It says that by definition, anything that has been researched is already out of date. That's not quite what you said, but I think it's close enough to the spirit of it, isn't it? And therefore, if you rely only on medicine which has actually been evaluated and shown to work or not to work, then you will always be behind the state of the art. Okay? And this is true. This is a true thing. It has to be true. It's true almost by definition. Now, what I think that speaks to, however, is how do I deal with that? I refer to that to my colleague David Haydorn in the BC Office of Technology Assessment, who is spends a lot of time worrying about these things and is medically qualified, which I'm not. But his reply to that is to offer as a principle that therapy should not be based on the hypothetical results of studies which have not yet been carried out. And I think I'm quoting him more or less accurately. Now, that's in large part a rhetorical response to your point, however, because your point still stands, that's fine. Then when do you ever do anything new? And I think the answer then, the sort of substantial answer has to be, when you're doing something which is non-proven, you better bloody well be honest about it. The patient should know that you don't know whether this works or not. You think it works, you've got reason to think that, or else you shouldn't be doing it, but it is not yet proven that it does. Okay? And in a lot of cases, you find that argument is the argument that you've made, while in principle I think is a powerful one, in practice it is often used where it really doesn't belong, where you sort of say, look, the evidence that we have says that this intervention doesn't work, and you've come along and said, yeah, but we're now using the this thingamajig instead of the that thingamajig, so it's all different. Why should the onus, why should the burden of proof always lie on the evaluators who have to come along after the fact? The other point that David Haydorn makes is the location of onus is absolutely critical, as any lawyer is well aware. Do you have to prove that what you're doing works in order to justify doing it, or do other people have to prove that it doesn't work in order to try to get you to stop? And historically, the pattern in medicine has been other people have to try to prove that it doesn't work in order to get you to stop, and they've got to prove it according to standards developed by the people who are doing it. This tends to be difficult.
Okay, I have two more questions.
Not in the charts. Sorry, I beg your pardon. Not exactly. The question was, do we have, we've got this data on expenditure, health expenditures total, health expenditures by component, hospital, doctor, et cetera. Do we have a breakdown by age? And the answer is yes and no. No from the federal data that produced that I'm relying on there. They don't have that. Yes for provincial government reports. Some of it is in published annual reports. The Saskatchewan government, for example, this routinely publishes a breakdown by age. If you go beneath published reports, you can get enormous detail in each of the provinces, and indeed some of the research we're doing here at UBC up on the fourth floor does have that data by 5 years of age brackets, and so yes, we can give it to you by expenditure per capita by age, and we have that data, and by age and by year. However, having said that, I can give you expenditure on doctors by age, on drugs by age over 65, but not under, because they're not, everybody's not covered by pharmacare. On hospitals, no. I can give you utilization, days per thousand population, number of admissions and separations, measures of use, but not measures of cost, because our hospital data systems don't connect up cost with use. You could estimate cost from the use data, but we don't price hospital services individually. So that's what we have. Sorry, a little louder. A little louder, please. Sorry. Well, first of all, the question was, it wasn't so much a question, it was a comment. It brings up the issue of prevention, because people who go to hospitals at late age do so because they have neglected or abused themselves at an earlier stage. That's, I think, a pretty hard comment to substantiate. Sunbathing, why anybody ever imagined that sunbathing was a threat in Vancouver, I cannot imagine. It just boggles the mind. And in any case, if you have that kind of problem, there has been in the last 10 years, particularly the last five, a dramatic increase in the proportion of short one-day, less than one-day surgery for elderly patients. So if you have a little growth that has to be nipped off, you probably won't wind up in hospital for more than a few hours, if that. You'll get processed, but as you do now, for example, for a cataract. But again, cataract surgery is one of the heaviest use procedures for the elderly. It's got nothing to do, as far as I know, with abusing yourself. That just happens to be you live too long, so you got a cataract problem. So you're going to have a tough time, I think, linking up most of the things that elderly people wind up in hospital for with earlier abuse. I mean, there's a kind of a in the literary sense, I mean, I've got to be careful of my language here. What I learned in high school about literary styles, a pathetic fallacy. And I'm not sure that I've got that quite right, but I've been that in the technical sense, and so maybe right. The reason we keep believing that what we did earlier makes a difference is because we'd like to believe that we can, by taking thought, keep ourselves healthy and live long. And we would like to avoid having to face the fact that an awful lot of things just happen. You know, we'd like to feel we're in control. And to some extent, we are, but not nearly as much as you think. And the danger is that the next stage beyond you're in control is, and therefore it's your fault.
Okay, we've got lots of people wanting to ask questions. Take one last one. Dr. Aaron, we've got you.
Your economic study is good enough, yes, to answer such questions. What is the optimum aim for us to survive to for the most economic efficiency?
Any economic study which purported to produce such a number is by definition not good economics. You cannot, Chris Archibald, who used to be in the economics department here, had a very nice paraphrase of David Hume, no ethics in, no ethics out. All right? You cannot get ought statements from is statements. And good economic studies are supposed to be about is, about what's going on out there. If you want to insert value judgments into them so that you can state, we all ought to be dead at, say, whatever, the age keeps getting older as I do. I think it's legitimate to do it, but you'd better be honest that you are introducing your own values at that point. You cannot base it on economic analysis, and you cannot claim to have an objective, scientific, whatever, you know, social science is an oxymoron, for gosh sakes. You can't do it. Now, this is extremely important because there are economists, otherwise respected, running around out there who claim in print that you can get values out of objective analysis. I don't know where what they've been smoking. And my colleague David Donaldson and Chuck Blackerby have been trying to beat these people over the head for years. They're just wrong on technical grounds. You can't do it. However, as a community, as a society, and this is what Daniel Callahan at the Hastings Institute has been on about. As a community, we may want to, he thinks, I don't think we need to, but that's another question, we may want to think about what the appropriate levels of intervention are at different ages. But then he's operating in an American environment where the costs are just beyond belief. I mean, they have totally flubbed the social institutional ingenuity side of things, and now they're just hanging in the wind.
Now call on Dr. Eric Vogt to thank our speaker on our behalf.
The Vancouver Institute has a very fine tradition of great performances on wintry, snowy February nights. You join the tradition, Bob, we've had Margaret Mead, we've had Joseph Karsh, who drew full houses on nights such as this. I think most of us would agree that we're lucky in Canada to have the kind of health system that we have. I think also, we've heard today again, that this health system requires nurturing, it requires flexibility, it requires fine-tuning, it requires ingenuity. And we're very fortunate in Canada that the engine driving quite a piece of that ingenuity is Bob Evans. We've heard from him tonight. I know that people like Peter Seaton and David Sinclair, who worked with him on BC Health Reform, were very, very pleased with the ingenuity he provided for that. So we're lucky to have Bob in the system, and he's today explained really how perhaps we can, with some luck, perpetuate or keep going with the Canadian system. Bob cuts such a wide swath through science that through much of his lecture today, I wasn't quite sure where he was going. You know, you were dealing with, for a while, a long while, with renewable resources, deterioration, social conflict, and then divisions. I thought that he, with his typical generosity, that he was perhaps trying to set the stage for next week's lecture, in which we're going to hear about the problems of Canada and Quebec. And then the question, of course, is, what is the renewable resource which is failing us now, which is leading to the possible separation of Canada and Quebec, or even the partition of Quebec? And I think that's something he wants you to think about. Now, what is the renewable resource? Probably the one that I can think of that is eminently renewable but isn't being renewed is good politicians. And perhaps this analysis that Bob was setting up for us was all an aid of bringing all of you back next week, Saturday, to hear about the problem of Canada. Now, it's a very easy job today to on behalf of all of you to thank Bob Evans for a great performance. Thank you.